Welcome, everybody, to the Medication Safety Technical Advisory Panel conference call. Welcome to our returning TAP members and to any members of the public who are listening today. Our TAP members we've been in contact with, and just to let anybody else know who's listening, we had some changes to the agenda from since when we first posted it. We should have an updated agenda up on the web now, but there were a few measures that were pulled off the list for consideration today because we had some concerns raised about the expertise on the panel and related to some of the specific measures, and we will be addressing those measures in a separate call. Some of them will also be being moved to a separate project subsequent to this patient safety measures project. Dr. Now, did you want to make any introductory comments or any welcoming remarks?
Nothing other than to say welcome back and thanks to all of you who submitted your evaluations.
I would also say thanks to everybody who submitted evaluations. We'll be pulling those up on the screen on the webinar during the call for you to review and to sort of serve as a starting point for discussion. So I guess we can just go ahead and get started with our review of measures. We're going to get started with PSM 01710, which is patients with rheumatoid arthritis taking methotrexate, sulfasalazine, or leuflamonide that had serum ALT or AST test in the last 3 reported months. This is an Ingenix measure. And operator, I would ask if you to put in the Ingenix representative onto the speaker's line so she could give a brief introduction to the measure.
Her line is open.
Great.
Hi there. This is Jessica Reilly from Ingenix. Can you all hear me?
Yep.
Great.
I can hear you.
Okay, so this first measure for rheumatoid arthritis is looking for patients taking methotrexate, sulfasalazine, or leuflamonide that had a serum ALT or AST test in the last 3 reported months. And these are based off of 2 things. First of all, the pharmaceutical manufacturer, which recommends an ALT and AST in the first 1 to 2 months every 1 to 2 months after first starting therapy, times 6 months, and then once every 3 months after that. And then the American College of Rheumatology guidelines from 2008 recommend transaminases every 12 weeks at least after the first 6 months of therapy. So there's a little slight difference between the time frame, and our expert panel usually chooses the most conservative time frame. So we went with the last 90 days of the report period to look for the serum AST or ALT.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Bingham, I believe we had you as the discussion leader on this measure. If you want to give just a few thoughts on what you think the strengths or weaknesses of the measure are and some general thoughts on how it stacks up against the measure evaluation sub-criteria.
Yeah, so I think comment number one is that now, there are a couple of proposed measures looking at monitoring for some of these immunomodulatory drugs. There's this one looking at ALT-AST in the case of rheumatoid arthritis. There's also a measure proposed by Ingenix looking at ALT and AST, including methotrexate for patients with IBD. And, in fact, the period of time that's being looked at for those in the case of this measure is 3 months. In the case of the IBD is 6 months. But we're dealing with the same drug. So I have, you know, while recommendations, you know, that are all based on consensus rather than any form of data are being used to base these measures, the fact is that the truth that yields potential patient safety is clearly not established. So I guess that would be sort of point number one, and we'll come back to this when we deal with the other measure regarding transaminases with these drugs. Comment number two is that we're lumping 3 drugs with different mechanisms of action in terms of safety monitoring. And while these have been lumped again and according in sort of the ACR criteria or the ACR recommendations, I think this again is consensus-based rather than data-driven in terms of putting all of those together. The true differences that occur in terms of liver function test abnormalities is not really discussed in this, in terms of how frequent or how severe these do occur, also in terms of putting this into some form of perspective. We do have that type of data for some of the other measures that we'll review today, such as for the interferon with MS.
Hi, Chris Cowdley here.
Yep.
Sorry, it took me a while to figure out the call-in information, but I got it. So.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
So I do have a problem with sort of the you know, the determination of monitoring frequency and there being some differences between the two things. I have a few questions in terms of the specifics throughout the thing. There is inclusion of patients' concomitant medications, but I was never quite clear on why these were included, including hydroxychloroquine, anakinra, rituximab, abatacept, TNF inhibitors, that don't seem to have any relevance to whether or not patients are on methotrexate or necessarily even being specific for the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. So I'm completely unclear in terms of what those are adding. As I brought up on the prior call in terms of reliability testing for the NGINX measures, the information that's provided in terms of reliability is coming from a chart review of 100 charts out of a multi-million patient database looking across a range of measures and not looking at any reliability or validity testing in this particular scenario in terms of how reliable the data is. And then I guess my final sort of general comment is that there are other measures that are already endorsed by NQF dealing with liver function tests in patients starting disease-modifying drugs and then within the first 3 months of monitoring methotrexate, and there's no real discussion of overlap or how these would complement that type of information. And then I guess my question back to the people from NGINX is, what is the actual monitoring period that's being looked at? 3 months is what the measure says, but I was very unclear whether it may actually be a six-month window that's being looked at in terms of whether or not liver function tests are being done. And then I guess one more comment would be that while looking at the recommendations for IBD, there seems to have been discussion with the American Gastroenterologic Association. There's no mention of any type of discussion or evaluation by the American College of Rheumatology in terms of an evaluation of whether or not this measure is appropriate or in line with what the intent was of similar quality measures that were developed by the professional organization. Those are my general comments.
Okay, this is Dan Solomon. I agree with Bing's thoughts. I would just add one other comment that the demonstration of a deficit in current practices, there is some literature on this issue, and I think there's some papers that were published in the last 4 or 5 years, observational studies that suggest that about two-thirds of patients, at least on methotrexate, receive monitoring of their liver function tests about every 3 months. So at least for one of the drugs here, people are doing pretty well. They're not perfect, but pretty well. And so I think it's worth just considering whether there's the overall need for this. Is it going to fix care, or is this already being done largely?
Thanks, Dr. Solomon. Any other thoughts from the TAP members?
Well, this is David Bow. I think that there's some good comments and concerns raised. I guess, my understanding was that the specifications of the measure put forth here are consistent with the guidelines put forth by American College of Rheumatology, but it sounded as though Dr. Solomon was suggesting that they're not consistent with that. I thought in my reading of some of those guidelines, it looked as though there was the recommendation for liver function testing to happen at least every
12 weeks on an ongoing basis, and certainly more frequently earlier treatment. But am I incorrect in my reading of the ACR guidelines regarding monitoring of these drugs?
Dan, do you
have an Ingenix representative still on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Do you have any, could you speak to that, or do you have any sense of whether the measures recommendations are in line with the American College of Rheumatology's recommendations?
The American College of Rheumatology's guidelines recommend transaminases every 12 weeks at least for people on an established regimen of these drugs. So the measure is basically in line with those guidelines. In terms of, I think Dr. Bingham brought up, maybe it wasn't Dr. Bingham, but brought up, why don't we have any direct interfacing with the American College of Rheumatology, about these measures. We just happen to have a pretty close relationship with the American, with the AGA, and that's why we had that sort of added the added input on the IBD measures, but we basically relied on the ACR, the existing ACR guidelines for these measures. And in terms of the time period, Dr. Bingham brought up the time period. It actually technically is written that we're looking for these lab tests during the last 90 days of the report period through 90 days after the end of the report period. Now, this is that kind of 90-day, we call it either a run-out or a grace period, is something that we do for a lot of our measures. If this is problematic, we can take that out. It's just kind of, to give a little extra benefit of the doubt. But it does extend the time period significantly. So if that's problematic, we would definitely consider removing that kind of extra 90 days and just leaving it to a strict 90-day window.
Can I comment back on that one? I mean, I think, I wanted that clarification because that actually gives me a little bit more comfort, frankly, that there is a grace period of 3 additional months.
Okay.
Because, I think as I discussed previously on the last call with some of these measures, the practicalities of people being exactly every 3 months is often not able to be done.
Right.
And clinical, life does not allow people to follow exact rules of 90 days.
Right.
So that does give me some encouragement. One question, I guess, that I would have to you as well is in one of the measures for the IBD, it was stated that one of the measures had very low compliance and the time period was extended out to be further so that, I guess, more people would be in compliance. Indicating that sort of a measure had been already tested in some fashion. Has any form of testing of this measure been done in the RA population?
Well, for each of our measures, we do first a condition-specific, we get a condition-specific population of about 4,000 people, which we run the measure on. And then after that, they put it to 2 larger databases, one that's about 1 million, one that's about 15 million members, and those aren't condition-specific, but they do represent a pretty representative group of a commercial insured population. So there would be, definitely people with rheumatoid arthritis that qualified for the measure in that database. So we run it against the 3 databases. Now, do we, again, we discussed this last week. We don't do any, we don't do specific chart review analysis with every single measure. It's not really feasible for us to do. But we do, use these very large databases to test the measures.
Well, David, now I have another question about the grace period then. I think there is some rationale for having a grace period around the measurement period. However, in this specific case, what you're doing is you have a 3-month period, but then you're adding on another 3-month period, so really doubling the measurement period.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess then if you were to report out the results of this measure and saying that X number or X percent of patients had a test within a three-month period, then that's really misleading because you're looking at a six-month period. And so I guess that's where I'm a little concerned about how the explanation or description of this fits with the actual specifications you'd be using. And I just want to make sure they're consistent.
I guess what I would, how I would respond to that, and I agree, it is sort of misleading, but what it's looking for is 90 days prior to the end of the report period, and then you have that 90-day run out. Our specifications only technically require the patient to have claims data and coverage prior to the report period. It doesn't technically require the patient to have coverage going forward from the end of the report period. And that's why we don't call it a six-month window. We call it a three-month window because not every patient is going to have the benefit of that run-out period.
I agree with David that it should just be stated as it is. I think you're getting into I just think it should be clearer and more explicit because it does seem like it's a six-month measurement period.
And
I understand technically why you call it a three-month, but it really seems like it's 6 months.
I mean, we get into the same issue with the IBD, you know, and there for arguably the same drug, the measure is for 6 months, and then it adds on another 3 to 9.
Right. I have sort of
an implicit difficulty with, you know, on the one hand, we have a drug that we're going to say we're going to monitor it 3 months, and that's going to be the recommendation and a measure for safety. And on the other hand, we have another measure for a different disease with the same drug that says it's going to be every 6 months.
Well, I agree that it should be consistent with drugs and that the description of the measure and the reporting window needs to be consistent with the time periods actually examined. And I can understand, the NGENX perspective here, because I've actually done a lot of these types of analyses with claims data. So I understand that you want to have some sort of grace period after that's close to the measurement period. However, then you get into the inconsistencies if only some of the patients have a grace period and some don't. I guess I'm just, this is a concern I have across all the measures that have the grace period, even though I think clinically there's some relevance of it. I think it just becomes messy and almost misleading to say you're looking at a three-month period when really you're looking at quite a bit more than that.
Yeah.
Can I address a question back to NGENX again?
Sure.
And this was, again, regarding why the monitoring and recording of all of these other concomitant medications. What is the rationale for that?
So you're talking about those drugs that are listed under the denominator details
in
2A8? Okay. So you have their numbers 1 through 4, the different, you know, parts of the denominator.
Mm-hmm.
And what numbers 1 through 3 represent is the process that we go through to confirm that the patient has rheumatoid arthritis. And then number 4 is the sort of measure-specific criteria of the three drugs. So in section 3, there's basically two different ways in which a patient can be determined as having a rheumatoid arthritis. They can either have kind of two diagnoses of rheumatoid arthritis, one in a two-year period and then one in the most recent 12 months, or else they can have one diagnosis in the 24 months prior to the end of the report period but also have one of those drugs. So if they only have one diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis in the 2 years prior to the end of the report period, but they have also filled two or more prescriptions for any of those medications, then we consider them as having rheumatoid arthritis. So it's not really, it's not required for the measure. It's just one of the ways in which we confirm that the patient has rheumatoid arthritis.
Okay, so they would need to be coded as an RA, be taking one of these three drugs that are under study, and then could have, if they were taking an additional one of these other medications, then that would help. That you were saying that that would help you to say that the patient has rheumatoid arthritis.
Right. It would need to be accompanied by at least one diagnosis code for it, but yes, it's kind of just part of our condition confirmation process.
I mean, this is intuitively appealing, but it is based on no data. This is something that I've done a lot of research on. And I mean, if they're on one of these DMARDs, the DMARDs of interest here, methotrexate, leflunomide, or sulfasalazine, you don't need these other drugs to improve your accuracy of diagnosis. So I think that's just not. There's no evidence for that. If you have one DMARD plus a diagnosis, we don't really know what the accuracy of that is, but it's probably upwards of 90% for positive predictive value. But you don't need to have two drugs, so you're just kind of off into some evidence-free zone.
You're not looking for two drugs. You're looking for two or more prescriptions. So it's not just a one-time prescription. They want to see more than one prescription for it. But it doesn't necessarily have to be two drugs.
Let me ask another clarification question of our Ingenix guest. The measures that we're looking at around safety monitoring of the DMARDs and rheumatoid arthritis, are these part of a larger measure set that's related to rheumatoid arthritis?
Yeah.
And so then part of the exclusion criteria for these specific measures are probably matched to the other measures that are looking at other issues within RA. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that's, I'm just trying to understand the rationale for some of these, and I'm guessing it's just to make them consistent with the broader measure set.
Right. I think we have about 20 measures overall in the set. So these are just three of them. And many of them don't have to do with medication monitoring in any way.
Okay.
I just think that this laid out, it's just absolutely overwhelming in how one would even begin to take on and replicate this. But with that said, I certainly concur with my colleagues' comments on the dates and such, the time frames.
And I think, was it Dr. Bingham who brought up perhaps that that there are already some NQF-endorsed measures for monitoring of DMARDs, and I was trying to track back to the documents that we were sent that have the existing NQF measures, but I can't find it at the moment.
I'll tell you real quickly. I mean, there's one, it's number 590, that says that you should basically check liver function tests before starting a DMARD. And that's broadly a DMARD. And then there's 597, which says patients on methotrexate who are starting a DMARD should have liver function tests monitored within 12 weeks. So it looks at screening for safety before initiating a drug, and it looks for an immediate evaluation of whether or not there are difficulties occurring. But it doesn't address the ongoing necessity of monitoring. But it does have some overlap with that initial 597.
Okay.
Should we take a quick walk through the evaluation subcriteria and just get some impressions for each one? We can pull up the voting results here.
Can I ask a general measurement question? So say someone has your AST and ALT done at week 3 and then again at week 15, for some reason. But does the calendar, does the clock start again? I'm trying to figure out how one measures this longitudinally. I mean, I understand you've kind of created this measure based on calendar time, but that doesn't seem to reflect biology. If trying to measure this over time and someone happens to get a couple done, but what happens to the calendar time? Does it get restarted or static over the course of a year? This is a question for NGENX.
So you're saying, does this kind of look prospectively, like getting, you know, do things get reset with each test?
If for some reason a patient of mine has a couple tests done in a 3-month period, does the time run out after 3 months and then you restart the clock, or does it end with the last test? Because really, as patients should have it done every 3 months, not by a calendar, but you should have it 3 months since the last test was done.
Right. This measure is really only looking for one, and it's looking in a discrete window of, I see what you're saying, but this is looking at a discrete period of time. You know, we have what we call the end of the report period, kind of the end of the data, although a lot of people do have that run-out data. Then we look 3 months backwards in time. So if the end of the report period is 12/31, we're going to look back 3 months prior to that date and look for the test. And we are looking only for one test. We're not looking for a series of tests.
Okay.
You know, that's something that we are very interested in, is kind of doing kind of a prospective kind of measurement where you look at, you know, at the most recent test and then determine, you know, roughly when the next one is due, but we don't have that capability right now.
Okay.
Well, and I think that relates to the purpose of adding in the grace period as well, is because there may be some patients who, have the test on January 3rd after the measurement period ended, and that's pretty darn close to being within the 3-month window, and you might want to count that. The challenge always is, how big of a grace period do you allow, and how do you reflect that within your measure description so that people can appropriately understand what you looked at? And so I think that's where my concern was, that if you have a 3-month window and then you add on another 3-month grace period, that's not just a tiny grace period, that's a complete whole other period. And so I guess that's a concern about all of the measures and the technical specifications, not just the specific one. So I guess that's the concern around that, the duration of the grace period.
Yeah, I mean, measure descriptions are easy to change, but I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, in this instance, we've doubled that the time frame that we're looking at by adding that grace period. So I don't know if you think that it would be helpful, we could consider a much shorter grace period. I'm not sure if you think that would be helpful. And then, you know, I mean, in terms of changing the description, I agree that the description is very misleading, and we could probably work on the description itself.
Yeah, and that's where different measure developers have taken different approaches to this. Some say it's 3 months. They allow a tiny grace period around that. Some don't allow any grace period. Some just say, you know, the guidelines say 3 months, but we're just going to state that we're looking over a 4-month or a 6-month period, and therefore, you know, but it's clear in the description that it's actually a 6-month period you're looking at. And so you can say, you know, the guidelines say it should be every 3 months, but because we want to offer some grace period, we're going to give that bigger window of time, but it's just clear in the description that it's a bigger window. So I guess that's where it's just a general principle, but I guess I think that just the general approach that you've taken with this set of measures.
I,
causes me concern.
Can I just go back to, again, I mean, we'll deal with it again with the IBD ALT AST issue. But in that one, in the data collection section 4E1, it said that, you know, the measure from on IBD was actually changed initially from being every 3 months to every 6 months. You know, which makes me a little bit concerned that, you know, if you did hold too tightly to a 3 month window without a grace period, that you're going to have some, you know, you're going to have a measure that a lot of people are not going to be in exact compliance with. So I certainly favor the idea of a grace period. How long you make that is unclear, but I mean, you know, I'll address it back to NGINX again. You know, when we deal with measure number 20, can you explain to us what you found in that evaluation when you were actually looking at 3 months and the decision to move it to 6 months?
I wasn't involved directly with that, but I believe that the compliance was awfully low when they tested it initially with the 3 month time period. So that was why they extended it. And there is a little inconsistency between the two time frames. And I understand that that's perplexing. Again, you know, we based the rheumatoid arthritis measures strictly on those. On a combination of the ACR guidelines and the pharmaceutical manufacturers, whereas with IBD, we did have the benefit of a little bit more direct interaction and input from the AGA.
I think it's also interesting to note that, you know, with a three-month guideline, gastroenterologists prescribing these drugs, only 38% of them were meeting the recommendation, whereas rheumatologists currently using the guideline as it's written have a compliance of over 66%.
Right.
You know, but I find it interesting that gastroenterologists are people who are usually very concerned about potential hepatotoxicity of these drugs, and yet their compliance as a specialty in prescribing, you know, would suggest that they're more liberal than rheumatologists in terms of their incorporation of this type of thing into their practice.
Right.
And there may be any number of reasons for that. Part of it may be, I guess the concern here is if it's just incorrect measurement of compliance with that rate, or if it's something truly related to the discipline wherein perhaps there's less attention given to these particular drugs and their monitoring, gastroenterology. You're essentially arguing it probably would be the opposite, but I guess that's where it's going to be tough to figure out why there are those different compliance rates. But I think they should be consistent. You know, so if we're monitoring methotrexate, it should be consistent regardless of the underlying condition of the patient, because I think the risk of the hepatotoxicity with the methotrexate would not vary highly across different types of patients.
No, and in fact, as with some of the other recommendations that we're going to be looking at, hepatotoxicity is much, much higher with other drugs that we're going to be evaluating today, but the frequency for monitoring those is even less than what we're discussing in either one of these two measures.
And this is Steve Muthing, and my question is for rheumatology experts, because I'm coming from a lack of knowledge of the incidence, being a pediatrician, is what is the incidence that we're trying to prevent? What's the risk of not monitoring AST? What percentage of patients do we anticipate having a bad toxicity?
Dan, do you know those numbers? Any?
You know, for methotrexate and leflunomide, I can give you some estimates. You know, in a year of taking the drug, approximately 5 to 10% will have abnormal liver enzymes,
right.
And it's probably, you know, far. I mean, it's probably 1 in 1,000 would have real evidence of clinical hepatitis. Maybe it's. I mean, there are obviously cases of fatal hepatotoxicity. They're uncommon, but they're in the order of one in a couple thousand for methotrexate and leflutamide. I actually don't know what the numbers are for sulfasalazine at all. I don't know if our GI colleague would have a better handle on that.
It's very rare. The hepatotoxicity risk is probably, in fact, much higher with mesalamine than it is with sulfasalazine. And in fact, I would say the data would suggest that it's quite negligible, other than from any sulfur-related hepatotoxicity. So from the use of asulfadine, you know, I think the liver enzyme elevations are always hard to really assess, because in this population, just as in the RA population, there is a number of other things going on. But it would be definitely in the lower end of the 5% range.
Right.
Or even lower.
I think the other thing that's important to point out is that, you know, the liver function test elevations that we do see with methotrexate, you know, are rarely, you know, in the greater than threefold elevation range of sort of grade three toxicity. And if you look into clinical trial data sets, you'll see quite frequently that at 1 month someone has, you know, a 1.5 times elevation in one of their LFTs. The next month, the same patient without any intervention whatsoever, they're back to normal. And that's what we see in clinical practice. There's tremendous variability. Nobody's well established what is significant, and other people have suggested that it's not even the transaminases that are important things to monitor. It's actually the function that you would see through albumin or other measures.
I would agree. I mean, I think one of the biggest controversies in the whole methotrexate story is whether liver enzyme monitoring provides any useful benefit. We've sort of lumped these different drugs together. And for instance, if you look at azathioprine or 6-MP, there is a genotyping you can do to look for those that are poor metabolizers. You can look at levels of 6-MMPN or 6-TGN to see whether the patient is at risk of hepatotoxicity. Whereas with methotrexate, there's none of that. And in fact, I've actually published on this a little bit, so I reviewed the literature on several occasions, and there are really no data that monitoring liver enzymes mean anything. And I was, quite honestly, as a clinician and somebody who has published in this area, I was surprised at the frequency of monitoring recommended for methotrexate. I'm really not sure that, I mean, if you look at the, you know, certainly if you look at the dermatology literature and you look at the rheumatology literature, the prevalence and incidence of hepatotoxicity is quite different, just the same drug in different populations. So, for instance, in RA, it's extremely low. In psoriatic arthritis, it's factors of magnitude higher, et cetera. So it's easy to reproduce these things and just kind of repeat them, but I think the methotrexate is really not very clear. By contrast, I think for azathioprine 6-MP, there's good evidence that we have a at-risk genotype, we have a phenotype we can measure, and that it correlates with hepatotoxicity. So, and we have all of these kind of combined into the same measure. So all the drugs are combined together.
Can I make a general statement? You know, I think that we're all in agreement that there isn't good evidence for at least in RA, the methotrexate, leflutamide, sulfasalazine. There are very clear recommendations in the American College of Rheumatology that I think Ingenix has tried to be keep close to. And so, but those are, you know, having sat on those panels, those are based on experts' opinion and not a lot of data. And so I guess I'm put this back to NQF and the leader of this task force is, you know, how are we to manage this lack of evidence. You know, there is expert opinion, and we could stick to that, but we're all cognizant that that's really without a lot of evidence basis, and we're not. I think there's a couple of us who aren't quite sure whether we should just pass this along because it's in similar to what's been put forward by the ACR, a group that several of us are members of. So could the NQF or someone else help us think about that?
Well, this is David now. Let me just share some experiences of having brought measures before committees in these panels before. You're bringing up sort of the weakness of just consensus-based approaches wherein we have just a few experts on a particular issue. And that's where with some of these issues, there's enough wiggle room or uncertainty around them that, one small set of experts would feel comfortable, another small set of experts may feel quite differently. And so I think what you're pointing out is that the weaknesses of the underlying guidelines, not necessarily that Ingenix is doing something inappropriate with, how they're interpreting the guidelines, but the guidelines themselves on this issue don't have a lot of firm evidence to underlie them. And it sounds as though your concern really is that you don't want to, through endorsement of these measures, make these seem like a much more important and solidly evidenced recommendation than they really are. And so I can appreciate that. I think from the Ingenix side, it's probably going to seem frustrating that one group of consultants they worked with and experts said makes sense and another expressing concern. But I think that's where I think this panel just needs to, use its judgment based upon the evidence you're familiar with and the evidence given to us to say, do we think this, even though it's in a professional society's guidelines, is it still an important enough, well-evidenced enough issue to make it into a performance measure where physicians may be held accountable for not conforming to those guidelines? So, I guess that I'll let NQF staff weigh in as well, but I think we should just go with what you think is the most appropriate judgment here.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Dr. Now, and I would point out again that the TAP is not making actual final recommendations on the measures. They're making their recommendations to the steering committee, and they're going to point out again strengths and weaknesses of the measures and rate the evaluation subcriteria and refer that to the steering committee. So I would encourage you to note all of these concerns that you have, these weaknesses that you're bringing up in the measures, and in your final evaluation, make note of those weaknesses or those concerns in the online form, and take them into account when you're doing your final ratings, and we'll use all of that information to inform the steering committee's decision on these measures. So just I would again encourage you to provide as much information for the steering committee as you can, based on your own, opinion about how the measure rates.
One suggestion might be, I think for most of the topics, we have experts from various specialties, which I think is a nice thing. Usually you have rheumatologists issuing their guidelines and hepatologists issuing their guidelines, and we don't really consult with each other that much. So one, and I think this is something we could ask Ingenix, and maybe a suggestion would be, as we come up with these measures, it might be nice to have a reference to the measures as to what is the quality of the data or of the evidence that informs those measures. So in other words, we went through this for hepatitis C. And for instance, in hepatitis C, even though there's a lot of evidence-based stuff about monitoring patients on treatment, the data about monitoring liver function tests was really just a paragraph that came out of the practice guidelines, which then You can't blame Ingenix for using that information that came from the experts. But I think it might be useful to the steering committee to say, well, okay, what is the quality of the evidence? Maybe we can have a reference or just a little, you know, something like that. I don't know if that's feasible.
Sounds reasonable. And we'll be providing a summary of the TAP's deliberations, and we'll be providing that to the steering committee. And we'll circulate that to you as well, so you can, you know, review it and add anything to it that you think is needed.
Now, I just provide people with an additional reference, which is Visser, V-I-S-S-E-R, the first author from the Annals of Rheumatic Diseases in 2009. And this is from the European evaluation of methotrexate monitoring. And they actually go through this issue of safety and liver function tests and have reviewed all the literature. The level of evidence is actually 4, and the grade of recommendation is a C.
Yeah, the expert opinion.
Right. Yeah, but the level of evidence is actually quite poor.
Yeah.
You know, and this is sort of the comprehensive review of everything to do with methotrexate and monitoring and safety.
I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, I'll tell you what I've done. And, you know, I've been a hepatologist for 25 years, and what I do is I recommend that, you know, after every cumulative 4 grams of therapy, do a liver biopsy. And if after 2 consecutive biopsies there's no change, then leave it up to the patient and the individual case. So I don't even follow these guidelines myself. I mean, I think it's reasonable with any drug. Idiosyncratic type of reactions are going to manifest themselves more likely than not early into treatment rather than later into treatment. And so, for instance, statins is a classic example. Things that are going to declare themselves generally happen within the first 6 months. But to mandate every 3-month monitoring forever for a patient that's on methotrexate, for instance, is an enormous undertaking with no evidence whatsoever. So,
we should probably kind of move along a bit here. Would you like to run through the specific evaluation subcriteria, or does everybody feel comfortable with the concerns and questions that have been raised at this point to do your evaluations after the call?
I think we've covered the key concerns and actually covered concerns that are going to be the same for many of the measures we're going to discuss today. So I think we can move along.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Okay, well, let's move on to the next measure then, which is PSM 01810. Patients with rheumatoid arthritis taking methotrexate or sulfasalazine that had a serum creatinine in last 6 reported months. The Ingenix representative, do you have any remarks about this measure? Or?
Just real briefly, again, these are based on the ACR 2008 guidelines and also the manufacturer's recommendations. The manufacturer's recommendations are a little vague. They say every 1 to 2 month creatinine monitoring for methotrexate, and then periodically for sulfasalazine. And then the ACR guidelines say every 8 to 12 weeks after taking the medication for greater than 6 months.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Solomon, I believe we have you as the discussion leader on this measure.
Sure. So these are methotrexate is a drug that is metabolized cleared renally, so changes in kidney function would be important to note to make sure the dosing is not becoming, excessive. It can have direct renal toxic, nephrotoxic effects. I don't know of evidence about the frequency of the nephrotoxic effects. There's case series, but I don't think I've ever seen any good epidemiology on that. I don't know if it's an early versus a late effect. I don't think anyone's really defined that. But from a rheumatologist standpoint,
I'm concerned about changing kidney function in someone who, you know, may have other medical conditions, and making sure that I'm not overdosing someone on the methotrexate because that can become quickly toxic. So it seems prudent to me, just based on kind of medical science, to want to monitor serum creatinine on some regular basis. I don't know if it's, you know, again, I think the 12 weeks is a bit of you know, evidence-based medicine and not necessarily based on any clear data.
I think, you know, this one goes to 6 months, which I think, you know, again, while the recommendation's 3, this says 6, and I think, you know, based on the fact that we have even less data regarding creatinine than we do for LFTs, being more liberal for a guideline like this is certainly reasonable. There already are recommendations for baseline creatinine with DMARDs and a check within 12 weeks after starting methotrexate. They're also endorsed already. And arguably, the baseline is one of the most important ones, because many patients, you know, don't have comorbidities that would predispose them to worsening renal function, such that, you know, sort of Q3 monthly monitoring is a little bit, I think, onerous. The other one is, again, the issue of lumping sulfasalazine with methotrexate here. Now, I think with methotrexate, we clearly know that those toxicities increase with worsened renal function. But I don't know, and I mean, this would be a question back to gastroenterologists as well. I mean, what is the data with sulfasalazine in terms of worsened renal function leading to increased toxicity from sulfasalazine?
Do we have anybody who can speak to that?
Yeah, nephrotoxicity is really not much of a concern from my standpoint, and I would certainly say that as far as self, you know, for patients that have IBD that we're treating, we don't really routinely monitor that at all. So I think it's, I definitely think that in contrast to liver test monitoring, with all of its limitations, a relatively conservative, less stringent approach would be adequate from my standpoint.
What would less stringent look like?
You know, I would say that, you know, the issue really comes in if these patients are on other drugs that could affect renal function. So in other words, if they're on cyclosporin or if they're on something like that, then obviously you've got significant risk of nephrotoxicity, and it could be synergistic with sulfasalazine or methotrexate. So, you know, generally, most clinicians would not feel a need to monitor these more often than even once a year.
It also becomes kind of moot because, you know, the reality is that people don't order individual liver function tests. They order a panel, and, you know, they get a basic or a comprehensive metabolic panel that's going to include a creatinine sort of automatically. So people see that. I mean, to me, sort of the upfront monitoring of a creatinine before you start a DMARD to make sure you don't need dose adjustment is the more critical measure, which is already endorsed.
And I'll just add another kind of feasibility issue and question, which has to do with kind of the combination of the measures that you have. For one measure, it's 3 months. For another measure, it's 6 months. It becomes onerous on the part of the physician and even the information systems to remember which medications require monitoring at which intervals and what monitoring is required. I think that it's, again, a lot of these things are consensus-based, and you need to go by the guidelines, but I think it becomes very taxing for providers with the growing number of quality measures that are existing to remember exactly how to perform and all these things. And I think, again, there's within information systems, there's rule fatigue, alert fatigue, and are these really the ones that make most sense? And I suppose, can there be to the last commenter's point, that it's just easier to do it all at once, but that leads to over-ordering and increasing costs.
Yeah, and from what I'm hearing, it sounds as though the consensus is that the evidence around the appropriate interval of monitoring and the importance of the creatinine monitoring is probably less important and less clear than with the hepatotoxicity monitoring. Is that sort of the general consensus I'm hearing, is that the creatinine is maybe less of a concern than the hepatotoxicity monitoring?
Well, I mean, so I'll just, I think that for methotrexate, I might disagree or say that I think it's important to be doing renal function in patients on methotrexate. Every 6 months is a reasonable estimate. Sulfasalazine, I agree that it seems much less important, but I wouldn't forget about creatinine to someone on methotrexate.
Well, I think that's where it just, as this goes to the next step with the steering committee, that's where I'm trying to think about what are the sentiments of this advisory panel and whether, it'd be generally supportive or more supportive of, if you had to pick one, you'd pick the liver function test, or whether we should just say both are worthwhile and appropriate. I think that's ultimately the kind of decision the steering committee is going to have to make, and that's where I'm not hearing overwhelming excitement for the measure as it's stated with all the drugs and so forth. So I guess that's where there's more I guess the lack of enthusiasm and it is sort of telling here that, it's not necessarily that creatinine monitoring is a bad thing. It's just, it's not one of the highest priority issues needs a quality indicator around. Am I reading you correctly?
I would agree with you. I would say, again, that the idea that checking a creatinine or DMARD for started is another quality measure that's already out there. To recognize that the drugs can be affected in people who have reduced renal function. You pick up that quality assessment with that other measure potentially.
Okay.
Creatinine. And for many patients, and I agree back with the gastroenterologist, for many patients, there are no comorbidities. There are no other concomitant medications that would increase renal toxicity potentially, so that frequent monitoring is certainly not indicated. I think Dan, on the other hand, raises the issue that, we'd like people to periodically look at it, but how often that is, I think there's no way to establish that.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, just one example, I found a review on DMARDs and renal toxicity, and it states very clearly, this is a review of every European and medical and American journal on nephrotoxicity in RA, and they sort of categorically state cyclosporin, gold, and D-penicillamine all have serious potential for renal effects. Concomitant use of NSAIDs increases the risk. In contrast, methotrexate, azathioprine, antimalarial, sulfasalazine, leflunomide, etanercept, and infliximab have relatively little renal toxicity. So, and you would follow from there that there would be no role for any monitoring in those patients. So, again, I think the concept that we're evolving is, and maybe the way to do this would be to say, I think it's important for clinicians to, assess the patient's risk of hepatotoxicity and nephrotoxicity when they are initiating therapy, and possibly within the first several months of therapy, because we don't know about, what effect there might be of flunomide in a patient that's taking massive doses of NSAIDs, and what effect there might be on creatinine. So I think that baseline assessment, recognizing the risk of nephrotoxicity and the underlying risk, and clinical judgment cannot be underweighted. And then after the first 6 months, for certain drugs, the risk is probably pretty low if the renal function is normal. Whereas for others, it's not so low. So, for instance, as I quoted here, I mean, they sort of classify these into different categories, and so we can't put them all into the same category.
Okay. Yes, are there other issues that we should cover with this specific measure?
I mean, I guess I'll just kind of make the additional point that I think, again, what we're hearing is that, should there be monitoring of creatinine in patients who are on methotrexate and some of these other agents, it seems like, it probably would be a good idea for some patients, maybe not others, I guess, the interval is certainly not clear. But the question is, again, what we're trying to do is to get to one of the very highest standards. Is this something that is good enough to be a National Quality Forum endorsed quality measure for public reporting? And that's where I'm struggling with these measures.
Okay. I mean, it feels like, the measure has been created because it's an easy place to look. There's a recommendation, and you can do this in claims. But but it doesn't feel like it's really that weighty or strong or evidence-based that we can all get behind it.
Yeah. And I actually, I'll send to all of you a paper that should have sent you the protocol that looks at the study that looked at pre-video laboratory monitoring for a lot of drugs used on a chronic basis, and it shows for methotrexate chronic users that about 78% had their creatinine monitored at least every 3 months, and 84% had their ALT or AST monitored every 3 months. So it looks as though even this recent study suggests we're not way off from the ideal currently. Okay. Well, it sounds as though I think we've captured the sentiments here on this measure. Andrew, should we move to the next one?
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and do that? Sounds good. Thanks. So that would be PSM 01910. And that's individuals with rheumatoid arthritis 2 years of age or older taking methotrexate, sulfasalazine, gold, or leflunomide that had a CBC test in the last 3 months of the report period. Dr. Bingham, I think we have you as the discussion leader on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can go back to the prior discussion that we've had. I don't know, we have a lot of discussion. This one also has the three-month grace period on it. It's expanded the list of drugs that are being monitored. Arguably, all of them can have effects on CBC, probably to a different extent, and some of them probably need more, if a patient is on gold at a Q3 monthly basis, there aren't a lot of those people anymore, but, you'd need a CBC at the time of the injection. But again, this has all of the same problems that we've talked about with the other measures. What frequency is the appropriate frequency, I think, is not as clear. But certainly, the cytopenias are something that can be, certainly associated with increased risk to the patient, so that more frequent monitoring is probably better than less frequent monitoring in this regard. I think the three-month thing, whether you should have a little bit of a grace period around that, I think is a reasonable thing to discuss and think about. But all of my other concerns that I raised regarding the other Ingenix measures, regarding the concomitant drugs that are in here, you know, TNF antagonists and other hydroxychloroquine, et cetera, are all the same as I said before, as well as the issues of validation of this particular measure. And I think it is notable, again, when we look at even their internal evaluation here, I think that the compliance was pretty good with this already, sort of at the level that we were with the ALT-AST. I'm trying to find that again, but those are my only comments. I think we've discussed everything else.
Thanks. Any other thoughts? I would just point out that some of these issues around the current performance on the measures would be a good thing to note in the importance to measure and report section of your evaluations. There are a couple of sub-criteria that relate specifically to that issue. So just, again, I would encourage you to take a look while you're doing your evaluations at the briefing memo and the specific guidance around evaluating the measures, and there will be, you know, I think a lot of the discussion here relates pretty closely to those sub-criteria, and you can find a place to express your concerns in your evaluations.
Can I ask you, if we wanted these notes into our evaluations now, how do we access what we've already input into your system so we can update that with some of these notes?
Yeah, we could do that. We can send around the final version of the spreadsheet that we downloaded from the web tool before this call and send it out, and then we'll clear all of that out and have you re-enter in your final evaluations after that. But we can send you what you had entered previously, so you have sort of a baseline to go off of.
So I'm sorry, we can't just use what we've done and then update that?
I'm not sure as a question of sort of our technical ability to do that. I think we may have to clear the data out to recirculate the survey. But again, we can at the very least send you the data that you input from the previous survey, and you can look over that and, you know, either cut and paste any text that you had entered or see the ratings that you had given on each particular sub-criteria. And we'll look into whether we can just have your data pre-populated, but I'm not sure that we have the ability to do that.
Well, it's actually kind of functioning now like an Excel spreadsheet for us, so maybe it would be easy to do that and just resubmit it.
To just enter it into the spreadsheet itself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should be able to do that. We'll look into it and we'll get back to you. But that sounds like something that could be pretty feasible.
Yeah, I've done things similar to that before where we sent it back out for people to amend their ratings or comments. We just asked that they put any new comments or any changed ratings in red. And if they have no changes, just send it back saying it's fine, or if they wanted to make any changes, they just change theirs in red text, and that way you know that it needs to be changed in the master.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks.
Well, can I just ask just a generic question? What kind of goal do you look for compliance with the measure to say that people are doing well? Is there an established number that you sort of are aiming for?
I don't know the answer to that question myself.
80%.
I don't think anybody knows the answer to what's ideal. I mean, certainly there's, you know, for measures where higher scores are better, you want to be closer to 100%, but in reality, you know that you're never going to reach 100%. And so I think that's where the use is more for looking at trends over time to see is an individual provider improving from prior periods of performance, or to do some relative assessments to say who are the top 20% of performers. So you don't know that these, 83% is ideal or 75% is ideal. It's sort of relative to either other providers or relative to your past performance. I think that's the more simple way to try and use it. Well, do we want to move along to our next measures, or is it time for the public comment?
I think it is time for public comment, so I would ask the operator, if there are no more comments on the measures from the TAP members, I would ask the operator to open up the lines for anybody who wants to make a public comment.
And if you would like to make a public comment today, you may do so by pressing star 1. Again, that's star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. And there's nobody in the queue.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So then we'll go ahead and move on to the next group. The first measure in that group, these are the inflammatory bowel disease measures. The first one is PSM 02010, patients with inflammatory bowel disease taking methotrexate, azathioprine, or mercaptopurine that had serum ALT or AST tests in last 6 reported months. Sorry for any garbling of the medication names there. Just looking at who we had as the Dr. Cowdley, I think we had you as the discussion leader on this one.
Yeah, so we've sort of, already touched on some of these issues. Methotrexate, azathioprine, and 6-mercaptopurine, which is a metabolite of azathioprine, are all have documented hepatotoxicity. And so there is a need for trying to identify those individuals that have hepatotoxicity. The proposed measure is identifying a proportion of individuals that have had a serum ALT or AST measured in the past 6 months. So the measure would identify these individuals with a diagnosis of IBD, taking methotrexate, azathioprine, or 6-MP. And just looking at the evaluation form, I would make a couple of points. I would agree with that there is evidence that this is a high impact issue. Hepatotoxicity is well described with both of these drugs, and laboratory monitoring of liver tests is in fact useful. There are several references here. Interestingly, I didn't see any practice guidelines from the AGA, which surprises me. There are some recommendations from rheumatology societies. Leaving aside the caveat that ALT-AST monitoring has limitations, this would be a reasonable way to survey. And looking at the data that were compiled, and I'm not an expert in interpretation of this, so I would ask for help from others, but states the compliance rate was 38%, which indicates there's a clear gap. So from a clinical perspective, I would say that hepatotoxicity is a significant concern, that we need to be monitoring for it, in contrast to methotrexate in rheumatoid arthritis, where progressive effect on hepatic fibrosis may not be apparent by monitoring liver enzymes, which is really the major source of hepatotoxicity. With these drugs, it's more an inflammatory process, and so liver enzymes should be more useful. And so this seems like a very reasonable measure. It seems like something that can be implemented and should be broadly applicable. And it sounds like there's a significant opportunity for improvement here. Although I would ask the NGINX colleagues if there are really, in fact, no GI society recommendations about this, I would be a little bit surprised. So it seems pretty straightforward, and I think that we should endorse this, particularly given the what appeared to be, unless I'm interpreting this incorrectly, what appears to be a relative big gap in terms of the frequency with which surveillance is done based on their data set. Can we ask if the NGINX person is still there, whether there's any GI society practice guidelines or recommendations about this?
This is Jessica. I don't believe that there are any. I mean, we did work a little bit with the AGA with these measures to refine the time frame, but there aren't any actual guidelines that I'm aware of from the AGA.
Do they have any similar things for biologics or just none for this whole disease state in terms of therapeutic monitoring?
You know, I don't know for the biologics. I mean, I can look into that, but not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Not surprising to me. But anyway, so I think this is pretty straightforward, and there's clearly an opportunity here to improve.
Yeah. Can I just add, and this again gets back to what I had raised before. You know, when they change the I think the 38%, as I read in section 4E1, the 38% was based on compliance at looking every 3 months. And when they changed it to every 6 months, the compliance actually goes up to 69.6%.
Oh, yeah, I'm seeing that now. Thank you for bringing that to my
attention. Yeah, which, again, gets to this issue, you know, sort of with the RA versus IED.
Yeah.
You know, is the gastroenterologists see this as not as important to monitor as frequently as rheumatologists?
No, they're too busy doing colonoscopies.
Right. You know, but if the compliance with checking every 6 months is almost 70% right now, you know.
Your point is that
My point is that, you know, for the RA recommendation, we're dealing with 3 months.
Right.
You know, for GI, when you liberalize that up to 6 months, you know, you get essentially everyone within the compliance that is, you know, presumably twice a year they're going to be checking.
Well, I think what you're saying is that, you know, we're always more comfortable with our own specialty, right?
Yeah.
And I think that a rheumatologist probably is more nervous, maybe more nervous about the liver and maybe monitoring it more often. Certainly, if you take the same population of patients and look at the risk of hepatotoxicity, it's largely, at least with azathioprine and 6-MP, it's going to be driven by dose. So I'm a little, you know, I don't know what kind of doses of azathioprine and 6-MP are used in the rheumatology population, but in the GI population, the dosage, you know, is generally in the probably 1 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram range, rarely 2 milligrams per kilogram. So and we know with, at least with azathioprine 6-MP, dosage is very much related to toxicity is related to dosage. So one possible explanation for this difference in compliance may be that the higher doses are used and so higher risk of hepatotoxicity. The other possibility is that there's just a higher comfort level among GI doctors that these drugs are not as hepatotoxic. So I would ask rheumatology input about the dosage that is used. Is it much higher than what we use in GI?
No, and you know, in fact, for rheumatoid arthritis, azathioprine is rarely used. I mean, we use it in other disease states, and also heart.
So certainly, it looks like I'm quite comfortable as a clinician with based on what I know about a 6 month level of monitoring. And I also know that in our own practice, it's very rare to monitor every 3 months, liver tests in stable patients. So I guess I would say that if we set 6 months as a target, it's reasonably good. And it also gets to this issue that's been pointed out several times, that the shorter, the smaller your window, the greater the likelihood that you'll be out of compliance, right? So
I just forwarded in the chat feature. I'm not sure if anyone saw this, but there is an ADA position statement on use of immunomodulators in inflammatory bowel disease dated 2006, and they recommend after initially starting 6 month captopurine, measurement of complete blood count with differential should be performed as clinically appropriate at least once every 3 months. Periodic measurement of liver associated chemistries is also advocated periodic, and that's a grade C recommendation.
Again, I think CBC with azathioprine is maybe different from LFTs. I think from a 6-MP and azathioprine perspective, making sure that somebody has a TPMT check before they start the drug is arguably a more important safety measure to be looking at.
Exactly.
Right, and as you pointed out, that's already an endorsed measure.
So I think we're in general agreement that a 3 month interval might be unnecessary, that a 6 month interval is reasonable, and at least as far as ALT and AST, I think that as far as measures go, it seems to meet the criteria that as I understand them, for saying this should be a measure that we should encourage.
And to add on to that, considering from the patient perspective what's going to be practical, I would agree.
So I guess the issue that I'm still trying to get some feeling for in terms of clear consensus, and maybe we can't get any, is the monitoring window. I mean, it seems as though people are fairly comfortable with the six-month window we're currently looking at. But should the prior set of measures are around the same drugs but in RA, should that also, would we be more comfortable if that were a six-month window rather than a three-month window? And do we think they should be consistent, or should we?
Well, I would wonder what a reanalysis of their data would look like if they went to rheumatologists and looked for, Q6 monthly. If the rheumatologists are already in sort of the 66 to 68% compliance with every 3 months, it's probably near 100% already in terms of a Q6 monthly monitoring.
I just would caution folks that I think the American Journal of Managed Care article is from Ballon Community Health Plan, which I'm going to – I wasn't sure. Was it a larger sample or was it just from Fallon, that article you sent around, David?
Oh, boy. I thought it was just Fallon, but I'm not sure.
I think if it's just Fallon, I don't think we should think of those as nationally representative data. There's rheumatologists. I can name them. They're all very academic rheumatologists. I don't think that's what's going on in typical practice.
Coming back to the point that was just raised, another issue might be sort of practice patterns. And I would ask the rheumatologists, how often they serve as primary care physicians for their patients versus consultants, because most gastroenterologists do not serve as internists for their patients. And so it's very rare to see the patient less than every 6 months. And so if you're not seeing the patient, you're not going to probably get the blood done. Whereas if the rheumatologists are seeing the patient more often, it's more likely that the blood test is going to get done. So there may be another variable here that simply has nothing to do with how well they adhere to these recommendations, but rather just the way in which they practice, you know, the practice is organized. Addressing the issue, I mean, I would like to be informed, but I see no inherent reason why in the patient with rheumatoid arthritis that the risk of nephrotoxicity, hematologic may be different, but because of leukopenia, but at least as far as nephrotoxicity and hepatotoxicity, I see no reason why there should be at higher risk than the patients getting treated for IBD. So I would feel quite comfortable saying that for purposes of being standard, you know, it should be 6 months. But I would like to get input on, could some of the differences in compliance be just the pattern of way in which the patients are seen in a practice setting?
I think that's probably true. I mean, I don't think Bing or I see patients as primary care docs, but we probably see a lot of these patients more frequent than every 6 months. You know, patients who have active disease are getting seen every 2 to 4 months. I'm just guessing. Is pretty typical in the practice that I'm in an academic center. And so we would usually be the ones ordering those lab tests, and therefore I think we would end up looking a lot more adherent than our GI colleagues.
Right, and that brings up yet another, not to belabor the point, yet another variable, which is that if you have an academic practice, you might have a referral bias that selects for patients with more severe or more active disease or complicated disease, and you might be the guys that are more likely to be writing the guidelines and making the recommendations about monitoring.
All true.
Well, so I think the initial recommendation of Dr. Cowdley was that he felt that for this measure, it seemed to make sense. It seemed rational at the 6 months. I think now what we're exploring is really whether the RA measures for the same drug should also be put on that same 6 month interval. We may not have to resolve that today, but sounds though, you know, there may be some rationale for just using 6 months consistently, unless someone has some strong evidence to suggest that it should be different.
I think the problem is that we've got professional associations that are saying 3 months for most of these, but we seem to be applying some variation in our standards about whether it should be 3 or 6 months based on our own guesses about what's likely to be best able to be achieved or by data that's been gathered. So it seems like we're losing. We're even straying from the consensus-based experts.
Part of the thing, though, I think we have to get back to are the issues of sort of, you know, representing the truth or what's important and also feasibility. And sounds like from the GI perspective, the feasibility may be a real issue that moves it to 6 months rather than 3 months, or at least one possibility. For how the data is normally collected and what the practice.
Yeah, and I can certainly tell you that if we were to say, well, okay, it should be 3 months for everybody. Hello?
Yeah, you're
compliant. If we were to say if it was 3 months for everybody, then you're talking about essentially based on current standards, you know, the majority, overwhelming majority of gastroenterologists are not compliant, right?
Right, 38% are compliant.
So if we're gonna say that the entire specialty needs to change how it does things, we've got to have some very good reason to make that statement. I'm not sure that I'm seeing the evidence here to support making it 3 months. And I would, you know, I would defer to the rheumatology colleagues. I understand the issue of, you know, if a society, learned society, has come out with 3 month and we say 6 months, maybe it seems like we're being more lax. But I would rather have a floor and say at least every 6 months. Other than the pain of phlebotomy and unnecessary testing and cost, I don't think there's any, no one will be faulted for monitoring patients more frequently. I think the issue is, what's the minimum level of frequency at which the patient should be followed?
And there's a compliance issue, and that's my only concern in all this is for the increased frequency. I think that, you know, we're risking the compliance piece.
Yeah, so I think that's where, you know, I think we can probably decide not to try and resolve this on the call today in terms of 3 versus 6. It sounds as though, at least with the one for IBD, the 6, we're okay with that. Whether or not the RA one should be changed to 6 just for the sake of consistency, I think is still up in the air. But I think, too, certainly there's a lot of factors that would affect imperfect scores on these. And really, by going with the larger window of every 6 months, I think as was pointed out, if you find patients who aren't getting it at least every 6 months, then that clearly is a safety problem.
It's a very good point. Very good point.
You can't really argue at that point, well, maybe they just fell just outside the window. Well, if it's every 6, then that's you can't make that argument. So I think this would still be useful in picking up those outliers who really are at high risk now.
This is Andrew again, and what we can do is we can provide your concerns to the measure developers, and we'll give them an opportunity to either change the specifications of their measure, to extend that time window, or to provide a response on why they're going to leave the measure as is, and then we can have you again make your final evaluations after seeing the measure developer's response.
Okay. Should we move on to the next one?
Sure, let's do that. So that is PSM 03010, patients with inflammatory bowel disease taking methotrexate, sulfasalazine, mercaptopurine, or azathioprine that had a CBC in last 3 reported months. Seeing who's the discussion leader on this one, and I believe it is Dr. Cowdley again.
Okay. So there's, I think we can go relatively quickly through this. We've kind of addressed a lot of these issues, particularly with regard to technical aspects of monitoring CBCs. And I think it's been pointed out by several people that both azathioprine, methotrexate, and sulfa drugs can all have a suppressive effect on the bone marrow, and given the fact that some of them may be synergistic, monitoring blood counts is appropriate and should be done at some regular frequency. So from a clinical standpoint, this makes sense. And there are several reviews that have been cited and also some recommendations from the American College of Rheumatology to support this set of measures, support this measure. And there's clear evidence that that we know that monitoring blood counts, particularly with regard to azathioprine, can provide benefit because we can adjust the dosage and monitor metabolite levels, and lowering the dosage can result in improvement. The key question, which probably is beyond the scope of what we would do, is that it's not clear to me that making those changes and changing that the dosage will in fact reduce bleeding episodes, infection, etc. I'm sure that there's no evidence that the consequences of monitoring or decisions based on monitoring actually change outcomes. Looking at the performance gap data here, I'm looking at 1B2 and it says the compliance rate is 41.7%. Now, remember, we're talking about 3 months. So a little bit better than with the liver enzymes, but probably still, I would suspect, would be lower than what was reported by the rheumatology population. And so with the caveat that we don't know that monitoring actually results in improved outcome, we do know that monitoring will result in ability to adjust dosage, which can then result in better CVCs. I think that this is a reasonable, measurable, and testable outcome. So I don't have anything else to add. I don't know if were there similar data that I missed on 3 versus 6 months? Is that also in the section four? Didn't see that, but for 3 months, it's 41.7% is what was reported. So those are my comments, basically. And then in 4D1, they talk again that claims could be missed if the patient is hospitalized. Guideline recommendation, it says testing every 8 to 12 weeks at a minimum. If at least one test was done during the last 3 months of the report through 90 days after the report period, that would, again, 6-month time frame would minimize the likelihood of error. But I didn't see the data of how often we have results, what the percentage would be if you measured every 6 months instead of every 3 months. But I believe that the current data was 41.7% for 3 months. And I would say that it is reasonable, based on what we know, that for blood counts, 3 months is probably a valid time frame. Although I must say, in my own practice, I don't do it every 3 months. I do it every 6 months.
Any other thoughts on this measure? Hearing none, we can go ahead and move to the next measure on this set, which is PSM 03110, patients with inflammatory bowel disease taking methotrexate that had a serum creatinine in last 6 reported months. Jessica Makrangel, I think we had you as the discussion leader on this one. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share.
Well, just to add on to what we've already been discussing, the good news is this is a 6-month time frame. Can make a lot of sense. And I noted in 1B2 that the demonstrating performance gap was 45.4% compliance rate. I thought it interesting, again, no rigorous research defined appropriate screening intervals, and the recommendations largely are rheumatology generated, with the thought that none of the national gastroenterology organizations have specified any kind of monitoring recommendations or guidelines for this. And that's really anything of mention here other than what we've already talked about.
All right, thank you. Anybody else have any thoughts they'd like to share? Issues? We have basically the same kinds of issues with the previous measures.
That's how I see it at this point.
Is that the consensus among the rest of the group?
Yep.
All right. Well, I guess we will then ask the operator to see if there's anybody who wants to make a public comment at this time.
Again, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone at this time. And if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We'll pause for just a moment. And there are no comments at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Then we will move on to PSM 02110. That measure is adult patients with multiple sclerosis taking interferon that had a serum ALT-AST test in the last 12 reported months. Dr. Alper, I think we had you on as the discussion leader on this one.
Is it possible for me to defer to someone else? I don't prescribe interferon, and I don't have a lot of experience in this area.
Does anybody have any thoughts they'd like to share on this measure?
So the issue with MS and interferon is that there is certainly from a liver society perspective, I doubt there are any recommendations. But there is a MS being an autoimmune disease, or at least having an autoimmune component, and interferon being an immunomodulator, there is a potential for causing a flare or bringing on of autoimmune hepatitis. The interferon probably has minimal intrinsic hepatotoxicity. So, and we are frequently asked to see patients that have elevated liver enzymes, et cetera, on interferon in the setting of MS. So there's certainly some rationale for monitoring liver function tests in this population.
In terms of looking at this, I mean, again, I don't prescribe this drug, but there were a couple of comments in terms of this issue of how often to do things. If the current recommendations that they quote are for monitoring every 3 to 6 months, why is the measure proposing looking at yearly monitoring? I think it's question number one. And the other, you know, the rate of liver function tests and the grade and severity, again, they quoted a grade 3 in 1 to 2% of patients, which is at least a threefold elevation above normal, again, is much higher than what we see with a drug like methotrexate, where we're talking about less frequent monitoring, or I'm sorry, more frequent monitoring than it is for here. And I guess my last point was that, again, this one apparently had some endorsement by the American Academy of Family Physicians, who I would argue are really not the people that have any expertise in prescribing interferon, that, you know, evaluation by neurologists of a measure would be more appropriate.
Yeah, I think, interferon is used, as you may know, and I've used it in hundreds of patients, to treat hepatitis C.
Yeah.
And it's quite safe, but it is an immunomodulator. And so with an underlying immune-mediated disease, with a drug that is an immune modulator, I agree with you completely that particularly on the basis of their own reference that they cited here, which recommended 1, 3, 6, and 12-month monitoring, I'm not saying that once a year is wrong, but it's not clear to me what the basis for that recommendation would be.
Well, I guess maybe the issue here, the same as we've discussed with the others, that we want to provide a broader window for performance assessment than would be ideal according to guidelines, so that from a measurement issue, we're not having to wrestle with well, did the patient get the test 6 months and a day? And so they're one
right.
day up guideline, so this gives you a much broader window. So you can say, if they didn't get it within the past year, they're definitely not getting monitored.
Right. I think, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's probably the same general issue for providing that measurement window that's, for performance, that's broader than the guideline window, just to allow some of that wiggle room.
Yeah.
This one is actually an 18-monther. Because it's 12 months with a 6-month grace, as I read it.
Right, and I think part of it, and this comes back to, I think we can't just because it's not convenient. I don't think we can abandon clinical judgment. And I think one thing we've addressed with every one of these guidelines is that the person prescribing these drugs needs to know how to use these drugs, and recognizing risk factors for toxicity prior to starting therapy, and more intensive monitoring in the first several months of treatment is critical. And I think that we have to make that very clear. So for instance, the reason they came up with this is because in this recommendation, they talked about, and if you read in 1C7, they talk about recommendation for liver monitoring versus 6-12 months are clear. And then in the evidence that they compiled, they said every 6 months, and then after the first year, at least once a year. So they just, took the lowest common bar and said once a year. But if you read this article carefully, they say, which I think is right, clinically, you should check it at 1 month. You should check it in the first, 6 months. And actually they say 1, 3, and 6 months. And then at least once a year after that. And again, it sort of catches those patients that are going to flare early into treatment. And so if you just say once a year, all those early events would be missed. And we may, for the sake of simplicity, have lost an opportunity to educate clinicians.
Do we have the NGenX representative still on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
If you want to speak to any of this, feel free to speak up.
First of all, it isn't an 18-month measure. It's a 15-month measure if you include that 90-day run out.
I'm sorry, I counted wrong. Okay, it's 15 months.
Yeah. I do understand the concerns. It's a longer time period. I believe our expert panel were looking at, the guidelines are very clear for kind of the initial treatment with interferon, but after that they do get a little fuzzier. So I think by putting the time period as a year, they thought that was, kind of the most conservative. I know that they probably entertained a shorter time period, like 6 months at first, but, clinically, that may not, the neurologist on the panel may not have felt comfortable with that. So they tend to always be a little bit more to kind of err on the side of a more conservative time period.
Well, does the group feel comfortable with the 12-month time period here? Or do we suggest that this should be made more frequent?
Well, I would challenge it a little bit. I think it sort of belies an understanding of how interferon causes a biochemical flare. It's more likely to occur early, less likely to occur late. So I think that if you're going to just do it 1 month to 15 months, 1 year, 1 year to 15 months, windows after the treatment is started, you might as well just not even do it. It's my
opinion. Okay. So as it's currently worded, then it would not be highly useful for assessing quality of care.
Right. I mean, as their own reference sites it recommends very clearly, more intensive monitoring early into treatment and then more casual monitoring later. So unless there is, so I would propose that it be changed. You can, for convenience, you can split the difference and say 6 months, recognizing that there will be this window that we talked about. So then theoretically there may be some people that will go 9 months. And some that may get tested sooner, and I think that would be, that would make a little more sense to me than waiting a year.
Can I just make one more comment?
Yeah, sure.
I think another piece to why that there may be a little bit of difference in the time windows here. I'm not very versed on the actual pharmacology of this, but the interferon that's used in multiple sclerosis would be a little different than the interferon that's used in hepatitis. And the dosages would probably be different. And that may have come into play in the decision as well.
It's alpha versus beta. The doses used are actually higher with MS.
Okay.
And I'm not aware of any data that suggests that there's any difference in terms. This is not an intrinsic toxicity thing like we're talking about with methotrexate or azathioprine, particularly one that accumulates over time. This is more of a immunologically mediated flare where basically interferon will have an immune stimulatory effect. And it is true that alpha is a little bit less than beta. I mean, a little bit more than beta, but beta interferon is not that different than alpha interferon. So the issue is not so much that the risk is lower than with, the issue is not so much that it's lower because of the interferon used. It's more because it's just not a common thing. It's just not going to happen very often. But the point I'm trying to make is that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen more likely early into the treatment than later. So.
Gotcha. Okay.
If you sort of look at sort of other things that have been endorsed, I mean, in the RA side, they have those couple of measures that have looked at, checking a lab within a certain period of time after initiating a drug. As opposed to, as a measure to see whether people are checking something. I'm not saying that's right or wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm very.
It sounds like from what you're saying that would be the more important time to be monitoring this.
Right. So I would be very comfortable with a compromise that says something like we recommend consideration of one measurement, sometime within the first 6 months of treatment at a minimum. And then consideration of annual monitoring. I think that's fine. I would be very comfortable with that. But in contrast to the other things we've talked about, I think that once a year here is basically just going to catch random events rather than clustered events.
Okay. So I think that sounds like a recommendation that could be taken back by Ingenix to consider if they would like to amend the measure so that it would be more amenable to this group. But as it's currently worded once a year within the grace period after that, it's not going to be tremendously useful in helping to measure quality and drive improvements in quality or safety.
Yeah, and since I've stirred the pot here, I'll be happy to work with the Ingenix person to review any documents that you might find, and I'll see what I can find as well to see if there's some evidence to support that. But I think this should be tweaked a little bit, in my view.
Okay.
Thanks.
Cool.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so if you could find any other documents, feel free to just email me. It's Chris Cowdley, just directly, and then I can help you review those.
Will do.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other comments on this measure? Hearing none, we can move on to the last measure for today, which is PSM 02210, adult patients with multiple sclerosis taking interferon that had a CBC in last 12 reported months. Should maybe have some of the same issues we just discussed. Dr. Cowdley, do you want to speak about this one as well?
Well, I think this, what's the recommendation here? Is it once a year or is it once every 6
yeah.
months?
Yeah, once 12 months.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I mean, interferon's effect on blood counts are primarily related to bone marrow suppression. And in patients who are not cirrhotic and are not taking other drugs that suppress the immune system, I mean, that suppress the bone marrow, which I think in MS they wouldn't be, I think that seems just fine to me. I don't know what the background material was because I didn't review this one, but I don't have any issue with this at all.
The background that they provided actually said, you know, that every 6-monthly monitoring is what's recommended, but they quoted a leukopenia in 5 to 14% of patients. Again, is a magnitude higher than what we see from drugs like methotrexate.
That surprises me.
So, if that's what the data is and that's what the prevalence of it is, you know, how significant that leukopenia is, I don't know. The data's not provided. But, again, we're talking about, you know, a higher level of these types of effects than we're seeing for other drugs that we're recommending that they be monitored even more frequently.
I think this is
if the recommendations say here 6 months,
yeah,
then you know, and the frequency is 5 to 14%, then I think 1 year is entirely too long, especially you know with grace periods and other things like that.
I would agree. I mean, I think one you know we have an opportunity here because we do represent several different disciplines. We don't want to simply, you know, I mean, some of these may represent the biases of the various specialties. And just because they may have a bias towards more or less frequent monitoring, but if that's inconsistent with the toxicity data, I think we're obliged to point it out and at least introduce some measure of consistency.
Even also going back to the thing we were just talking about with the LFTs, with the interferon, again, the numbers that were quoted there in terms of frequency of significant grade, you know, 3 toxicities of 1 to 2% are, again, at a magnitude that's much higher than what we're talking about for drugs like methotrexate. You know, and some transaminitis, I think the numbers that they said were between 25 to 38%. And so, again, it's sort of this relative thing. You know, and who's making the determination of what's safe and what's appropriate.
Jessica Mock-Rangel, I think we actually had you as the discussion leader on this one. Do you have any comments or thoughts on this measure?
Not any more than it's just been mentioned.
Okay.
So, at least from the two folks that we've heard from, it sounds like there's a concern that every 12 months would be too infrequent to be appropriate, and that every 6 months would be the more appropriate interval to use in this measure. Is that, am I reading you correctly?
Yeah, I mean, if it's all level C, then we can't just be influenced by the bias of the experts from the various specialties, right? One group of experts can't look at the same data and come up with a different set of measuring intervals than another group of experts. So I'm comfortable saying, based on the data that we were shown, that this interval for CBC monitoring should be tightened.
Okay. And so I guess that could be another recommendation back to Ingenix to consider that.
I mean, the main issue with interferon is going to be bone marrow suppression, and I thought that would be very rare, but, you know, it appears that it's not that rare, so.
Well, I think that's where, you know, there's just the one article and one, you know, sentence from there talking about the prevalence of leukopenia being 5-14%. I think maybe be good for us to dig into that article and understand the context in which that was being said.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, I think it's appropriate for us to ask for the experts advising Ingenix to tell us why they felt comfortable with that level of monitoring when more frequent monitoring is recommended in other settings. So.
Yeah, the frequency of leukopenias and things developed as well could be found from RCT data from the beta interferons and looking at the populations there to get an idea of frequency of this type of toxicity. But I would encourage, you know, again, engagement of people who actually use the drugs with some frequency, i.e., you know, neurologists specializing in the care of MS, to get a better feel for what the real quote-unquote experts that deal with this on a regular basis would feel.
I mean, this feels like a somewhat of a general issue for what we're trying to do, is that we all feel a little bit primary data to feel like we're, as a technical advisory panel, able to really give expert opinion. So I'm been largely listening to last hour, but I just have felt somewhat frustrated that I don't have the primary evidence in front of us. We suspect that the guidelines were, we can't quite figure out how the recommendations were made at the level of Ingenix, and probably they come from the professional societies, but we don't have the primary evidence from that group. So I'm just trying to figure out how this works on other NQF technical advisory panels. Is this a common theme where the technical advisory panel is struggling with what is the level of evidence for the measures that are being proposed? I feel like that's been half our discussion.
This is Heidi. It's a good question. Yes, some of the steering committees in TAPS have in the past struggled with this, which is why we have had a recent task force look at exactly what rigor of evidence are we looking for and what would we like documented. And so I'm happy to pass around that report. It may be helpful for all of you to look at what we're going to ask people to provide in the future. Unfortunately, you know, this has occurred. The timing is not perfect. Those recommendations are going to the NQF board at the end of September. I think what you all do need to determine here, and we can work with Ingenix to see if we can provide additional information if it is available, but if what you have before you does not provide what you feel is a strong evidence base for these measures, that I think is what comes out in your ranking of the sub-criteria. And so we can go back and we can ask Ingenix to provide additional information. I suspect that most of this is probably consensus-based, and that's where you all, it will come down to you all determining whether you feel that there is adequate enough evidence available to support a measure like this, to be endorsed. But we can circulate that evidence task force report. It may be helpful for you to see what we're going to ask in the future, and it may help you frame what you see now, but I would just give you the caveat that this is not something that we asked the developers to provide at that point in time because it was still in development. So, but if it's helpful, we can provide that.
I know, it just places us in an awkward position. Understand that, because we're without the evidence. We're not blaming the developer. Process is such that here we are without the right evidence to to serve our role.
So I think it would be helpful for, could you articulate what exactly you will, you know, you think you would need? I think it will help us to figure out with NGenX if we can provide that.
Well, I think that the simplest thing to do would just be to take some of the articles that they cited within their submission and make those more readily available. So some of the professional guidelines for, that were cited for some of these, as well as some of the actual research that was done underlying some of those recommendations on the incidence of adverse events, some of those that are already, you know, noted here might be helpful to provide. I guess the other concern, though, is that we don't know if those are the only articles out there. So without, you know, someone else from the NQF staff doing a very thorough literature review to ascertain, are there, you know, what's the totality of the evidence, you know, I don't know that we're ever going to be able to reach complete satisfaction with having all the evidence. So I think that's where we just, you know, as you said, we have to determine if we have a comfort level with supporting the measure as it is. You know, if we don't either have enough evidence to make a good decision or feel it's a bad interpretation, then we can just say we don't support this measure moving forward. And then it's really, I think, most helpful then if we can identify those specific pieces of evidence that would help us become more comfortable. In some cases, there may just not be the evidence out there. So I think that's where, in this specific measure, having more evidence around the incidence of adverse events specific to the, what's being monitored, I think that would help ascertain the importance of monitoring, but then the frequency of the monitoring becomes still a very tough thing for us to come up with on our own. And I think what we really just have to do is, this is a general measure, and we have to say yay or nay, do we like it or not? And then, you know, we can give the guidance back to them, but then it'd be up to them to try and make us more comfortable.
I think that's a good assessment.
One other thing that I would say is that, you know, again, some attempt to interact with the specialty societies that are appropriate, you know, I think is very important for this type of measure, or this type of measure development. You know, and again, whether American Association of Family Physicians are the people that should be giving guidance on interferon is not clear. And, you know, ACR was really not engaged on anything to do with rheumatology.
So that I think even, I think those are good points, but I think even though, you know, we did look at the ACR recommendations around monitoring for, you know, some of the measures we discussed earlier, and we still had some concerns whether those guidelines from ACR were really solidly based on evidence for the specific intervals recommended.
Right. Well, again, I mean, I think that's where the engagement of the specialty society, rather than just reading their article, is what may be needed.
I mean, I think the general point is the most important point is that if these are going to be embraced by the people who will be, they'll be measured on, why don't you engage them early in the process? I mean, that's, you know, whether the details of the measures, I think, are very important, but I think the general principle is it does seem remarkable that there isn't more engagement in, you know, the expert societies that have thought hard and long about some of these issues. Why not have them be part of the process of stewarding the measure or developing the measure or commenting on the measure? I mean, here you have rheumatologists' opinions, but, you know, we're not necessarily representative of the society. And you have a liver expert, you know, we can do our best, but we don't. The process can be more inclusive and will yield a better outcome and output.
Well, and I think that probably some good general recommendations that NQF can pass along to all measure developers. The helpfulness of engaging with the professional societies and bringing forward anything.
Go ahead.
What is really concerns me is we're not going to be able to discern the lack of, you know, monitoring, or with the additional monitoring, what would be the marginal benefits and marginal risks. And because, you know, we're here for the last 2 hours talk about this time frame of measure, the practicality and reality, how would those translate it to have safer use of these type of medications? And that's, you know, I still, you know, keep, you know, mulling it over. If we implement these metrics, you know, and measurement and require the whole society, you know, to comply with, what are the marginal benefits we're going to get? And that's just not, I'm not so sure, you know. You know, is it just for measurement's sake?
I think that's a really important point. I really don't think we have answers to those questions for most of these measures.
Well, are there any other comments on this specific measure that we have before us, or can we move along to some conclusions? And Andrew, do we need another public comment opportunity?
Yeah, we'll give an opportunity for public comment right now. Operator, could you open up the line?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, it is star one on your touch-tone telephone. We'll pause for just a moment. And there are no questions or comments at this time.
Okay, thanks. Well, like you said, we could sort of take some time now to have, for some general thoughts or conclusions about the set of measures as a whole, or anything that you'd like to touch on from our earlier conversation.
Well, in terms of process, then the actual ratings that are in the spreadsheet will eventually be shared with the steering committee.
Correct. Yep.
And in between now and then, you'll also be drafting a synopsis of the discussion that will be shared back with us.
Yes.
While the perhaps the opportunity to adjust or add additional comments to the spreadsheet of ratings.
Yes.
Okay. I'm trying to think then. Then we've got some of the other measures. The cardiovascular ones moved out to another project. You're going to schedule you setting up a separate call just about some of the HIV-related ones.
Yep. We're working on that.
Okay. So in terms of the steering committee's consideration of these, how is that process going to work? So maybe that's something you and I can talk offline. As chair of the committee, I'm going to be presenting the sentiments of the TAP, or how that's going to work.
Yeah, that's correct. And we can certainly talk offline about that.
Okay.
But this is Heidi. I mean, just so everyone knows the process, it will be, we'll go back to NGENIX. And get any follow-up information, provide it back to you, and then ask you to go and re-rank the sub-criteria. All of that will go in a package to the steering committee. We will try to get that other call scheduled. It is 2 measures, so I think it will be a fairly short call, but get it done well in advance of the steering committee meeting in October, because we'd like to have it all considered at the same time. And then, yes, David, you'll be the point person representing the TAP. Outline any, so we will share a summary with the full TAP. Well, before that, you can provide any additional input. I don't think I'm anything, Andrew.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay, and that's where it seems as though if Ingenix comes back and suggests that they would want to make some changes based on our feedback, then we'd probably need to work through a process for getting that back out to the TAP for some email feedback prior to the steering committee's meeting. So we'll just, I guess, have to work through that as it unfolds over the next month.
Yep.
Do we know what's the deadline for our ranking to be in?
Well, what I just wanted to add to that is we will be in touch with Ingenix, and any changes that they make or any revisions that they've made based on your recommendations, we will forward those to you before you make your final ratings so that you have that information. We're hoping to get everything, you know, communicate with Ingenix with a proper written document in the next couple of days and give them about a week and a half and then give you a week after that. So we're hoping that we can begin your rankings within a week and a half to 2 weeks.
Okay. Is everybody comfortable with the process as outlined there? Hearing no objections, we'll move forward as we just stated. And does anybody have any concluding comments or things they'd like to note? All right, hearing none again, I think we're all set here. Thanks, everybody, for your participation. Thanks for submitting your evaluations before the call and for taking time to have this discussion here. We'll be back in touch with you very shortly with additional information and next steps on your further evaluation of the measures. So thanks again.
Thanks.
All right.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.